Ladies, gentlemen, and everyone in between, welcome back to another episode of the Thought Revolution podcast. Today's episode is one that I've been looking forward to for 3 months, because interestingly, we recorded this episode 3 months ago. However, due to some logistical issues and some personal constraints, I've had to keep this episode on hold for a while. Anyway, the guest today is Sy Gart, and the conversation is centered around God and religion. This is one conversation that I really did enjoy, not only because I'm naturally more fascinated by conversations around God, religion, the idea of, you know, how we got here, that sort of thing. You know what I'm talking about. And so Sy is a scientist who found God, right? For the lack of a better phrase. He converted to Christianity, and he has since been an advocate, or should I say an evangelist, for Christianity in his own way. So the direction of the conversation goes from talking about like the scientific basis for belief, you know, what does he mean to believe in God? What made him believe in God? And Sy strikes me as someone who is extremely intellectually honest. He's able to raise his hands and say, oh, hey, I don't know the answer to that. And he also seems to me as someone who is very humble. And by humble, I mean he is profoundly aware of the limit of his knowledge, which I find very refreshing. And so we have a very interesting conversation that centers around his experience, the ideas of God, the ideas that surround the ideas of God or the idea of God. This is definitely going to be an episode you would enjoy. And if you do enjoy it, please don't forget to share this episode with a friend or a colleague or anyone that you know that would enjoy listening to a conversation like this. And also don't forget to give the show a rating, a 5-star rating on either Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And that's it for me. The next conversation you would be hearing is a conversation with me and Sy Gart. Till next time, peace. Welcome to the Thought Revolution. You have had multiple conversations on multiple podcasts and interviews where you speak very passionately and convincingly about your conversion story, from atheism to Christianity, from being an unbeliever in God to being a believer in God. And so I'd like us to start this podcast by you attempting to answer the question, what exactly does belief in God mean?
Well, that's a large question. I mean, the word belief has a lot of meanings, and I have never studied theology at all. I've tried occasionally. I haven't even studied much philosophy, really. So some of my answers might not be on these types of questions, might not be very technical or even very accurate, but I'm just speaking for myself. So, you know, that without trying to be academic about it. If we start talking about science, I can be more academic because I know that. But in my own case, belief is the assumption that something is true. And I say assumption because when you believe something is true, and this applies in science and everywhere else that I know of, you also have to be ready to change that assumption. Something may come along and make you stop believing that that thing is true. And just to use an example, you might believe that your girlfriend loves you and you really feel that way. And there's lots of evidence for it. And, you know, she loves you and there's no question about it. And you're happy and then one day you begin to wonder if it's really true. You know, you see her talking to some other guy in a very passionate way. You wonder, wait a minute, why? Yeah. And then it may turn out that something happens and you have to change your belief and you don't believe it anymore. When you believe that something is true, as in that example, or in even less emotional examples, and then you find out that you made a mistake, that it's not right, that you have to believe something else, that can be emotionally very difficult. You know, it may lead to anger at your ex-girlfriend, for example. It may lead to feelings of mistrust. Now you don't think you can believe anything because you were sure this was true, and now you have evidence that it isn't. And so you don't trust these kinds of things anymore. You may not, in the example I gave, you may not trust any girl for quite a while because of this experience. Now, I know when we're talking about things like faith, I know many, many Christians who believe very strongly in Christianity and then don't, because something happened. Either they began to feel that the reasons that they believed in Christ were not real, they were not true, or something happened that made them question their faith, their belief, and they left. In my case, it was the opposite. I believed that Christianity could not be true. I was brought up that way. My parents were very strongly militant atheists. They were also communists. I believe that communism was the answer to every problem in the world. I went through, several things, including I'm pretty old, so some of this will be historical, but I went through the invasion. I didn't go through it. I mean, I read about the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Soviet Union, and that rocked my faith in communism. I mean, they were not acting like, you know, good people, the Russians. And eventually I gave that faith up. I gave that belief up, and I gave up a lot of other things that went with it. And my belief that Christianity was evil and bad and certainly not true came from evidence that I had been given about history, which turned out to be false, I found out later. And so I eventually gave up my faith and my belief in that kind of atheism, the kind of atheism that says not only is there no God, but Christianity and all religions are evil and you know, bad for humanity, bad for society. And I gave up that belief because reading history carefully gave me a very different picture of the reality. And I saw that, yeah, there are religious people who are bad and always have, but there are people everywhere, you know, of all kinds of things who are bad, believers, non-believers, etc. And it was very cherry-picking to only pick those wars where Christians or those acts where Christians were really doing bad things. There were just as many, in fact, a lot more cases of wars and other horrors that were not done by Christians or people of belief. So what happened was I lost my belief in that form of strong atheism, what we now call new atheism, because it made a big appearance around 15 years ago with the God delusion and all those books by the new atheists, who not only said that God isn't real, they said that the whole idea of believing in God has caused all the problems of humanity. Much like the communist, that was also part of the communist creed, was that, you know, religion is the opium of the masses. It's been nothing but bad. So I lost that faith. Now, that did not bring me to believe in God, because all that led me to say was, I have no idea. I don't believe in God. I still thought that was a myth. But I didn't believe that it was a horrible, evil, totally wrong, morally reprehensible thing to do. So I guess you could call me an agnostic or just a non-believer, you know, rather than a strong atheist. What that did was it allowed me to look at the question of God's existence a little bit more open-mindedly than I had been doing. Before that, I wouldn't even think of it. It was just out of the question. So that was the first stage that I went through, going from atheism to agnosticism. And belief in God was very, very slow for me. I mean, it took decades. And it started with other kinds of beliefs that were related to that, like the belief that there's something beyond the material, there's something beyond reductionism in science, for example. There are a belief that there's something in spirituality, which is true, that people are spiritual. They're not just, you know, they're not just products of physics and chemistry, and there's more to the human reality than just being, you know, an animal. My mother was a musician, and I studied music. I went to a music high school. I love music, and you know, when I listen to Bach or Beethoven or the Beatles or, you know, music, it doesn't even work evolutionarily. Where does music come from? It's something beyond easy explanation through chemistry and physics and even biology. So that these are the kinds of things that I started thinking about. What is this above and beyond stuff? And it's not just music. I mean, I can't draw anything, but I know that there are people who can paint. You know, there's beautiful human activity, art, dancing, creativity. You know, how do we come up with ideas? You know, all kinds of ideas. I mean, we can do things that are just strange. And I'll tell you one that you might find odd, but one of the things that really got me is humor. I really like humor. I like to make jokes. I like to hear people make jokes. I like listening to comedians. And do we know any other animals that make jokes? I don't think so. Where does that come from? What is humor? You know, humor is not definable. Nobody can define it. I mean, people have tried, and they usually end up, you know, making a comedy out of it because it's impossible to be serious and explain what humor is. But it's real. It makes us laugh. It gives us a feeling. What is that? Evolution cannot touch that question. Evolution can tell us a lot about where we came from physically. You know, our bodies are basically primates. But there's something else about us that goes beyond that. And when I finally read the first part of the Bible and I saw that it says in Genesis that humans are made in the image of God, I didn't know what that meant, of course. But eventually it dawned on me that maybe this is a clue. Maybe we are animals, but maybe we're not just animals. Maybe we're, you know, something else. And then what happened was I began experiencing evidence that there is a God. And some of that was very indirect. Some of that came from science, but not much. Things about physics, about quantum theory, and you know, the nature of electrons and particles was just, it didn't seem like it fit with a materialistic view of the universe, a clockwork view. You know, it's very random, it's very probabilistic. And that got me thinking too. But what really, the evidence that really convinced me to bring me to belief was personal, experiential. And I do not believe that the only evidence worth looking at is scientific. Scientific evidence is good to explain natural phenomena of various kinds, but not all. And there are even things within science that science can't explain. We can't explain why the constants in the equations of physical laws are what they are. They just are. They're there. We don't know why they're there. They happen to be the right ones. If they weren't what they are, we wouldn't be here. But we have no idea, not all of them, but many of them. And for any of them, we don't know why pi has the value it has. Why does Planck's constant have its value? There's so many constants. And we can't explore that scientifically. There's no way to do it. So I don't think science is the only source of evidence. And the evidence that I had was experiences that came to me both in dreams and awake, which I talk about in my book. And that I counted as evidence. And the last experience of that was a waking experience I had that was so powerful to me that when it was over, lasted about 10 minutes, I said out loud, "I believe," because of that experience and everything else that had been building up, dreams that I had. Now, when I say that, often I get a response from skeptics, atheists, that, well, so you became a believer because you had experiences. Well, you could have an experience of this or that or whatever, and that doesn't mean it's true. Yeah, but it's not just the experiences. If I had a dream that I saw a leprechaun, I would not begin believing in leprechauns. Okay. If I had a dream that there was a unicorn, I wouldn't start believing that unicorns are real. And it goes on and on. There are many things that a lot of people believe in that I don't, because I don't think the evidence is convincing. Aliens, you know, I don't believe there are aliens. Things like that. So it's a combination. So, you know, the question you asked is, how do you come to believe something? And I think it, first of all, it's different for every person. And second of all, for everybody, I think that it's a combination of your own personal experiences and knowledge and logic and rationale, sometimes from philosophy, sometimes from science. That all fits together. And in fact, that's true for everything we believe. Going back to my first example, if you believe your girlfriend loves you, it's not just because she smiled at you. It's not just one thing that did it. It's a combination of your experiences and things that you know about yourself, about her, about the world. And you put that all together and you are convinced that this is the case. And the same thing goes if you lose that belief. So, you know, can I say that I will never lose my belief in Jesus? No, I can't. You know, I admit that if there's suddenly a headline because somebody has found the provable skeleton of Jesus Christ, that would be tough, because that means the resurrection didn't happen. And as it says in the Bible, if Jesus did not rise, our faith is meaningless. It's not real. So that happened, I would lose that belief. Yeah.
Is that the only thing that could happen to make you lose your belief in, you know, in God? And I mean, the interesting thing with this conversation is that there is still, you know, a lot of conversation to be had about why a belief in God is necessarily a belief in the Abrahamic God, or, you know, Yahweh, as Christians would call him. And so my first question would be, what else, you know, I mean, the chances or the likelihood that anyone would come up with a proven skeleton of Jesus is, you know, probably zero.
Right. That's why I'm not too worried.
Exactly. So what else can convince you? What arguments do you think that a person can provide you that would be justifiable, or that would be sufficiently convincing for you to reveal your position?
Oh, you mean and not believe in God, or not believe
yes.
in Christ? In God.
Yes, in God.
Oh, I can't think of one, because I've considered all of them. And remember, I spent most of my life as an atheist. So, the atheist arguments are not strange to me. I have not heard one that I haven't heard before. I've never heard one that I haven't heard before.
It's interesting that the ideas for atheism and Christianity are often the same things. And this is why I believe that belief as a thing itself, there's a meta-reality to belief, because the arguments, the logical data have pretty much been the same for decades, and even for millennia, I can say. There have always been atheists since the first person claimed that there has been a God. And the arguments have only been switched to cater to the narrative of the zeitgeist of the time when they are being expressed. But then the core of those ideas are essentially the same. And most people on both sides, so atheism or, atheists and theists, I don't see any much convincing happening. It's almost like a tribal war these days where each person is almost just trying to defend their position. No one is being sufficiently open to more information. Scarcely have I seen a, transformation from a person saying, "Oh, here are the logical reasons why I switched over from Christianity to atheism," or "Here are the logical reasons why I switched over from atheism to Christianity." Although I often encounter, the latter more than the former. So I often see people using logic. I beg your pardon. I often encounter the former rather than the latter. I often see people use logic to find their way out of Christianity or out of theism, rather than people on the other side using logic to, discover Christianity. Why do you suppose that is the case?
Well, I okay, yeah, because there's a lot of things that are illogical about belief in God. And here is the thing you might find strange. Logic is highly overrated.
What do you mean?
Logic is a good tool. Okay, it can tell you what arguments are valid. It doesn't tell you what arguments are true. In other words, a logical syllogism, if it's valid, it tells you that if the premises are true, the conclusion is right. Because if you have two premises, let's say, I don't know, the standard example is, well, it's hard to even say that now. I was going to say all men are, but now we can't talk about gender and sex anymore. So we could say all horses can run. Okay. Jack can run. Jack is a horse. No, that's wrong. Jack is a guy. He's a human. So what's the problem there? Well, the fact is that all horses can run does not say only horses can run. If it said only horses can run, and it said, and then Jack can run, then Jack would be a horse, the name of a horse. That's valid. So what's the problem there is not one of the premises is wrong, but the argument is badly constructed. Okay, so in other words, it's not enough to say all horses, it's not enough to say horses, all horses can run. You have to say all horses and only horses can run. And there's names for these things. Each of these premises has a name. So if you have an invalid, the other way to have it, but you could have a perfectly valid argument. That argument is not valid, but you could have a perfectly valid argument, which is all horses and only horses can run. Jack can run, therefore he's a horse. That is valid, but it's also not true because it's not true that only horses can run. Humans can run also. So the premise is false, and if one premise is false, the argument is valid but not true. And many people forget that when they pose logical arguments. I've seen so many logical arguments where one premise is just completely not true, and that kills it. So it's silly to do it. The other thing about logic is that, it was invent, not invent, I don't know who invented logic, but it was used by the Greeks to find truth. And that worked sometimes and sometimes not, because it turns out that reality is not necessarily logical. This is certainly true in biology. I'm a biochemist, I'm a biologist, and using logic in biology is, it can't be done. It cannot be done. There's almost nothing in biology that's logically makes sense.
Why do you say that?
Oh, it's true. Yeah, you know, there's a very famous logical principle called Occam's razor, right? The simplest explanation is usually the best. Well, I have written about this in several places, including in my book. Maybe I can, well, no, I won't find it. I'll just say it. So let's say you have a reaction that's catalyzed by an enzyme. So you have A goes to B, and there's an enzyme that does that. The enzyme takes A and turns it into B, a different chemical, okay? Now, that reaction has to be controlled because you don't want to have too much B and not enough A. So B can inhibit, if there's a lot of B, it inhibits the enzyme, so the reaction stops. Okay, that's good. That works. That's simple. That's never what happens. What happens is B will stop the reaction. Another chemical called C will make the reaction go backwards, and that's inhibited by A. And then there's another reaction, another chemical D, which can be stimulated by the same enzyme to make E, and E will stop that first reaction, and on, there are often five or six different repetitive pathways which do the same thing as the first thing in biology. Who would have figured that? That doesn't follow Occam's razor at all. It's just the opposite. Almost every case, it's more complicated than it needs to be. And this is fact. This is biochemistry. That's how life works. There are reasons for it, but you have to do the experiments. You can't get it by logic. You have to actually look and see what are the different things that control that reaction A goes to B. And there may be 10 or 12, and they all do the same thing. It doesn't rely on just one. And the reason is fairly straightforward. The reason is because that reaction is important, and you got to make sure it's controlled. So you have more than one controller. You have lots of controllers. That's life. That's the way life is.
I'm super, what's the word? Curious to hear your thoughts on this. I want to ask you the question that Pontius Pilate asked Jesus, right, in the Bible, which is, what then?
What is truth?
Is truth.
Yes. And what was Jesus' answer?
Jesus declined to answer.
Exactly.
Why? Why? Why was that the case?
I love that part. Jesus had been preaching, I am the truth, I am the way, right? So why didn't he just tell Pilate, I am the truth? I've said it before. I don't know the answer to that, but it's fascinating that he didn't. I don't know the answer. Maybe the reason he didn't answer was it didn't matter at this point, you know, what Pilate thought. Or Pilate doesn't really want to know. If Jesus had said, I am the truth, Pilate would have said, well, I don't even know what that means. Go get rid, go die. he wasn't, you know, what could Jesus have said? It didn't make any difference at that point. But I don't know the answer why Jesus did not answer, but it's fascinating to me that he did not answer.
I think I find it interesting that Jesus declined to answer, because Jesus answering that question, in my opinion, would have solved a lot of controversies around what truth is. I think a lot of debates that goes on in the religious and atheistic spheres of the world today are concerning what truth is. We do not know where to orient our compasses in the search for truth. And I think if Jesus had done that, I'd answer that question. And this is, you know, me taking the assumption that there was a person called Jesus and he lived, you know, on earth and all of that. I think if he had answered that question, it would have solved a lot of problem. And I think this ties onto the next idea that I wanted us to talk about, which is the problem of divine hiddenness, which is why are we playing all these games? Why isn't the choice to choose God rather easy? If God is, you know, trying to make us choose him, I think if God, you know, is comes down in flesh today, like the Bible, you know, mentioned that he did in the person of Jesus, a lot of people will still decline, you know, believing in him, decline choosing his ways. And then the process of, you know, being a believer or non-believer becomes easy. And people then can be directly held responsible for the choices that they have made. But now with divine hiddenness, the question is, are we really making the choice to not choose God, or is God ensuring that the choice of choosing him or not is ridiculously difficult?
I got it. Well, let me go back to the first thing you said, which is if Jesus had answered that question, a lot would have been helped. What do you think his answer would have been?
Something along the lines of truth is, I don't know, the Father created, I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's hard to, you know, imagine what his answer would be, honestly.
I think the answer would have been what he said before, which is that I am the truth. I, me.
Then the question would still be, who are you? Like, what do you mean by you are the truth? We can't work with that information.
Well, we can if we assume that Jesus was God incarnate. In other words, God is the truth. Everything comes back to God. What does truth mean? I think that science is a good way to determine the truth of the natural world. So if we want to know how and when things happen, if we use our scientific knowledge, we will get the truth. We have the truth of, you know, how and when volcanoes erupt. We have truth of health. We know that, you know, smoking causes lung cancer. That's a truth statement. There are many things like that. Vaccines work. That's a true statement. And, you know, so science is one way to find truth, but God is also a way to find truth that goes beyond the natural. I mean, everything. It covers everything, not just, you know, the things that we can approach by science. So I think when Jesus says, I am the truth, he probably didn't answer because you don't like that answer, and he knew Pilate wouldn't like it either. So I don't know. But anyway, I your question about divine hiddenness is really very important. I mean, there are two big questions that have caused many people to lose their faith or to question their faith and wonder whether it makes sense to believe in God. And one of them is divine hiddenness. The other is the problem of evil, which I assume you'll get to.
Yes, definitely.
Let's start with divine hiddenness. Okay. So I wrote a fable, which is on my blog. It's a blog post many years ago, because I like to, you know, I like humor and I like writing funny stuff. So this fable, I'm not going to read it to you. I'll just remember what I just give it to you. But as I remember it, was that one day God appeared in the sky driving a chariot, and he had a big banner behind him saying, I am God. And he landed, and a bunch of reporters gathered around, and he spoke to them. Everyone heard him speak in their own language. And he said, I'm the Lord God. I am real. And he did a few, and I think in the fable, he landed right near Oxford University, and he destroyed it because Richard Dawkins was standing there. And and everybody knew that this was actually God. And he said, I am God. From now on, you have to believe in me. And somebody said, well, which is the right religion? And he said, it's Christianity and it's the Dutch Reformed Church. Everybody has to be a member of the Dutch Reformed Church. And they said, okay. And he said, okay, my archangel Michael is going to come down and he's going to be my spokesperson because I've got other things to do. I can't deal with you people all the time. So whatever you want, you know, you talk to him. And then he disappeared. And of course, everybody was amazed. I mean, God is real. It's absolute proof. You can't possibly, you cannot possibly doubt that God is real, right? And that lasted about 3 months. And then people began saying, thinking about God is a real pain in the neck, because, you know, Michael was telling them they have to do this, they have to do that. People didn't like it. And they stopped going to church, because why go to church? I mean, it's like what, you pray to the IRS? You know the IRS is real, but you don't pray to it. It's real. I mean, you pray to your computer. I mean, it's a real thing. God's a real thing. Okay. Everybody knows. There's no faith. And instead, in the fable, I had Joel Osteen start a new movement to worship Satan instead of God, because people didn't know if Satan was real or not. And Joel Osteen said something like, let's overcome the tyranny of Michael and, you know, worship Satan. And a lot of people did. And then at the very end of the fable, God wakes up and he had a dream, apparently. It was all a bad dream. And he sees Michael and he says, oh, my God, what a terrible mistake I made to show myself. And Michael says, no, God, that was just a dream. And then there's some funny jokes at the end, which I won't get into. But the point is actually not that unserious. You know, there's a reason that God is not 100% convincing, because there's something important about faith. And I think that it's very likely that the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ was a big step, because and look at how Jesus went. People didn't think he was God. They thought he was the Messiah, right? He was doing miracles. But he didn't say, I am God. He said, I'm the Son of Man. Sometimes he said, I'm the Son of God, which was very blasphemous in Judaism. But when he said, who do people say I am? And they say, you know, you're the Messiah, you come in the... He never denied it. He never acknowledged it. He did signs and wonders. He did miracles, and he preached. This was God telling us that we were on the wrong track. We were treating people as garbage. We meaning human beings. Tom Holland, who is a atheist historian and a brilliant guy, has written this book, Dominion, and other people have agreed with this, that most of what we now take as signs of being good in society, a good society, comes from the teachings of Jesus. In other words, we don't treat people as garbage if they're, quote, lower class. Now, some of us do, but we're not supposed to. And our laws reflect that. Our culture reflects that. You know, it's considered bad to treat people badly. Jesus said, love your enemies, love your neighbor as yourself. That was revolutionary. Nobody did that. Love your enemies? I mean, even the Old Testament, King David, every psalm is about killing his enemies. You know, make my enemies into my footstool. You know, it's all anti-enemy. Jesus went against that. He said, no, you know, all of you people are all my people. All of you, not just one tribe. Not just one group, not just those people in that tribe who do what I tell them. All of you are my people, and I love all of you, even the sinners. Remember that the Pharisees were very upset that Jesus was sitting with sinners and tax collectors. Why was he upset about that? Because you don't make these distinctions. You know, it was, and this continued with Paul. He said, there's no Jew or Greek, male or female, slave or free, all are one. That was that sentence. If you had said that to anybody else at the time, living anywhere in the world, they would have thought you were crazy. What do you mean? There's us, the good ones, and there's you guys, the bad ones. We're not all the same. Everybody felt that way. It's a human evolutionary instinct to feel that way. this whole idea that everybody can be loved, forgiven, accepted, the brotherhood of humanity, this is a revolutionary concept that was brought by God to Earth to tell us how we should live. So I probably got a little off track, but talking about divine hiddenness, so then your question still stands. Why doesn't God just make it clear that he's real? And I think he does, but not in the way that this fable is. Not by, you know, announcing it or coming down and doing miracles. I mean, you know, he did it with Jesus, and that was the one time he did it, and he's not going to do it again. Until, you know, whatever. I'm not into eschatology, so I don't know what's going to happen at the end of times. If there is ever going to be an end of times, that part I don't know. But he came once, his words were recorded, his deeds were recorded. He was part of the Trinity of the Godhead. He was God incarnate in a human form, and he came to tell us what we should do, how we should be, how we should act, and how we can be saved. And salvation is a beautiful thing in Christianity, because it implies that we have reached a point where we're supposed to be. And we can't do that if we just keep going thinking, well, it doesn't matter really what I do. I'll be nice because it's good to be nice, so I'll be nice. But yeah, it doesn't really work that way. I've tried it. I wasn't a bad person when I was an atheist. I was okay. But every now and then, I wasn't so good. Every now and then, when it really felt good, I sinned a lot. And I never killed anyone. You know, I didn't do terrible things. But I did some bad things. Things that I wouldn't think of doing now. I wouldn't think of it, because it would hurt people. You know, and I've repented of those sins. I treated women very badly. I mean, I didn't hurt them, but I was bad. I was not a good person when it came to, you know, my lovers. And I repent of that. I regret it. And I would never do that again. So, you know, it makes a difference. And is God really hidden? Well, certainly he was hidden. I thought he was hidden to me most of my life until I converted. And then I began thinking about things that happened to me and realizing that God was there. He was there. I didn't know it. I didn't hear him. I couldn't sense him. I didn't have any sense that there was anything there. Occasionally, I did have a little glimpse, and I've talked about that, and I'm not going to spend the time now. But occasionally, I would have a glimpse that there's something here. There's something going on. What's going on? And then I forgot about it. It's just, you know, it's imagination. It's, you know, it's wishful thinking. It's all the things that atheists say, you know. Your feelings don't count. You know, it's not your experiences. You can experience all kinds of things that are not true. And I agreed with that. Sure, that's right. But then it got to the point where I couldn't deny it. And it was just overwhelmingly clear to me that God is real, that Jesus is real, and he's there. And now I don't find him hidden at all. There's nothing hidden to me about Jesus. I mean, so many times, several times a day, I will experience something, see something, hear something, and I'll say, thank you, Lord.
I think what I find super interesting with the idea of, you know, the divine hiddenness is there's a scripture in the Bible, Romans 1:19, that says that everything that can be known about God, his invisible qualities, even his eternal Godhead, have been revealed through nature, so that people are without excuse. And I remember that when I was a Christian, that was one verse that seemed very controversial to me.
Yeah.
And the reason it was controversial is because when you say that everything, so let me attempt to break down the claim of that scripture. God is saying, or Paul, more accurately, is saying that Everything that can be known about God can be observed through empiricism. Empiricism is the idea that you can observe something interact with it, understand the qualities of that thing. And if you travel 1,000 miles east, west, north, south, regardless of where you go, as long as you're interacting with that thing, the qualities would be the same. I mean, I probably just butchered that definition, but then the core idea of empiricism is that you can observe from the nature of things how things are, and then infer certain characteristics or qualities of things from that. And God here, through Paul, is saying that you can do that. You can use that methodology to understand God. And here is the interesting caveat in that statement that I find most controversial. He's saying that so that people can be without excuse. So essentially, God is saying that the proof, the universal proof of my existence to all men, lest they be with excuse, is that I exist in nature. And so by the observing of nature, you should find me. The most interesting caveat in that scripture for me is the part where he says, so that men are without excuse. And he's saying that the only thing that would absolve you of, you know, the only thing that, like, basically the scripture is saying there can never be hidden or divine hiddenness anymore. There can never be the excuse of divine hiddenness because of nature. But then that's not what we see in the world. When Christians are trying to proselytize other people into the religion, they do not make an appeal to nature. They don't make an appeal to the things you see, the birds of the air. I mean, even I could argue that Jesus himself did that, because, you know, he was always speaking in parables and talking about the bread and the fish and, you know, the door, that sort of stuff. But then that is not what we observe in reality. We don't observe that God exists in the rocks, or God exists in the skies, in the trees. When we talk about art and beauty and all of those things that exist in nature, there isn't anything that necessarily points them back to God. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on those.
Well, that's one of my favorite verses in the Bible, actually, because I am a scientist and I believe that science does point to God very, very closely. Nature does point to God, everything about nature. And how can I say that? Isn't science the opposite of religion? Doesn't science conflict with religion? You have to choose one or the other? Absolutely not. My entire life for the last 10 years has been devoted to proving that that contradiction is nonsense. That's why I write my books. That's why I do everything. And the reason I say that is because science tells us a lot about how the natural world works using laws of nature. What Paul said was exactly true. The reality of nature is, to me, directly evidence pointers to the existence of God. And I have many colleagues who are scientists and Christians who agree with that. That the idea that science and religion, belief in God, are contradictory and in conflict is wrong. It was a concept that was invented in the 19th century. Before that, all scientists were highly religious. And the reason is because what science has told us about this world is that it's lawful and orderly. And that isn't what people used to think. People used to think that the world was chaotic and meaningless, and that things happened because there were gods or imps or demons who did things. That's why everything happened. It wasn't because of a law of gravity. It wasn't because of you know, laws of electromagnetism or any of the laws that we now know are true. And the thing about those laws is that they are true. They work all the time, not just if God or some demon decides they should work. So that was why Newton, Galileo, Copernicus, Pasteur, Boyle, Clerk Maxwell, Faraday, all these scientific pioneers who invented new fields of science, why they were all devout Christians, Lord Kelvin, on and on. Because they saw in nature the fact that the orderliness, the non-magical nature of nature, was a reflection of God the creator, that the universe was created to be this way. And the job of science is to explain and understand that creation and give and show mechanisms for how it works. So the Paul's comment that all the things are evident in nature is exactly true. The universe, the existence of the universe, where did that come from? Why is there life? It doesn't make sense that there's any life, by the way. We don't know the origin of life. We have no idea how life could have originated based on the laws of chemistry and physics. Now, I'm not saying that life was created by God as an act of, you know, divine creation, but there's something about the origin of life that is so mysterious that we're not going to be able to unravel it. I believe this very strongly scientifically. We're not going to be able to understand the origin of life based only on the laws of science that we now know in physics and chemistry. We're going to need new ideas. And I believe that those ideas will point very strongly to God, just as the origin of the universe did. Remember that for a long time, even when I was a kid, I learned that the universe was always here. It was eternal. It didn't have a beginning. Turns out that's not true. The universe had a beginning, which is, you know, we call the Big Bang. And, you know, when that idea was first broached, was first put forward, many people were very resistant to it because it sounded like it fit with the Bible. It sounded as if it, you know, it came from, you know, from religion. The universe began. If the universe had it began, well, how did it start? And that fits well with, you know, creation, with in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. Now, there are some physicists who think that universe was eternal. It had a beginning, or it went up and down, back and forth. There are all kinds of ways to try to argue against that. There are people who claim that the origin of life is almost solved. That we're very close to having. No, that's absolutely not true. And I'm telling you that as a scientist, not as a believer. Okay, we have no clue how life could have started. So the fact that there are birds singing in the trees, to me, is evidence for God. The fact that there are volcanoes which absolutely follow the laws of physics is evidence for God. Because where are those laws of physics come from? You know, why is it that the force of gravity is so simple? It's simply the product of the two masses, like me and Earth, right? Times each other, divided by the square of the distance between us. That's a very simple formula. Why is it so easy? And why does it work everywhere? And that's true for all the laws of physics. Until we get to quantum mechanics, and then we can't understand it at all, but that's another story. So, no, I think that that phrase in the Bible is absolutely perfect, and it does, it is correct. It makes us look at the world around us and say to ourselves, how can I not believe in God, a creator, when I see this world that's here? And we are here. And the people we love are here. And why are they here? They're not supposed to be. There's nothing in science that tells us why anything is here. The only reason we have is the creation by God.
I think the problem that I used to have, and I continue to have to this day with that scripture of the Bible, is that if we take for granted that nature or science isn't opposed to the idea of the existence of God, there isn't any direct argument that necessitates that it has to be God. We can posit that, you know, we are in a simulation, That also could be
Oh,
a.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Thank you. Yes,
So
we
I
can
would just
talk.
like to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh, I'd love to talk about that. So I saw a panel discussion with Neil deGrasse Tyson leading it. He's, as you know, an atheist, and there were several physicists, other scientists on the panel, and they were talking about the simulation idea. So actually, we're living in a simulation where everything was set just right so that we can, be here. There's a universe and there's life. And who's doing the simulation is was not never really discussed. The idea was, well, if we can already make simulations on computers in a very basic way, then imagine a civilization of natural living beings like us, but much, much more advanced, could probably make huge simulations, which would include something like our universe and all of us. Why not? So now I have a question for you because I've never understood this. Okay, what is the difference between God creating a universe and a teenage alien in his mother's basement creating a universe? What's the difference?
That's quite an interesting question you ask. I would say that the characteristics of the creator then has to be understood.
Right. So in other words, it could be that that we were all created by this teenage alien, but it turns out that the alien those aliens are incredible beings. They're not like our teenagers. They're omnipresent, omniscient, they're good, and maybe God is a teenage alien somewhere. I don't know. I doubt it, but who knows? I don't see any difference there. If you're going to believe in a simulation, you might as well just believe in God. There's no difference there, especially when it comes to issues like, why is there anything and why, where is, Paul's verse about, being without excuse. What's the difference? It's the same. And in fact, one of the members of the panel, whose name I didn't catch, but I have a feeling he was once a Christian, brought that up. He said, well, wait a minute, well, aren't we talking about God? Yes, absolutely.
I think the problem that I would have with the simulation theory, being God, I've not given it too much thought, so I'm basically just talking extemporaneously. If we accept that, we are living in a simulation, it takes away a lot of moral burdens, because then we can, and then, the universe, we automatically understand that we don't have free will anymore. It's just a very deterministic reality that we're living in. But then the problem with the God theory is, if we have to accept that, there is a God and then there's judgment, it's like, one, you're saying we were created in an environment, the environment largely shapes who we are, but yet we have to suffer on the basis of who we are. I think those would be the distinction. But then if it's a simulation, it's like there is no judgment, or at least I suppose there wouldn't be a judgment, right, in a
Well,
simulation.
we don't know that. We don't know whether or not, I mean, people are talking about AI all the time now. We don't know the future of this stuff. And it could be that there's a simulation. You could make a simulation where you give characters free will. You allow, you we can do that now. We just use random variables. And then you can't, and then it's no longer deterministic. I mean, I myself, I'm not very good at this, but I've done simulations for scientific purposes, looking at trying to model various evolutionary things where I've used random numbers to stand for probability. So it's not deterministic. I can't predict what's going to happen in the model
But
because
then,
there's a random number.
would that be free will? In a
Well,
sense, it seems to me like it's still deterministic, in the sense that the pattern becomes wildly unpredictable, but
right.
then it's not self-initiated.
No,
Like,
that's
it's not
true.
the.
That's true. But that's because we can't do that. But how do we know that can't be possible by, our friend, the future teenage alien? He may be able to do that. There may be a technology to grant characters free will to make decisions where to go. I mean, I don't know anything about video games, okay? My kids will do that. But I do know that there are video games where the characters have choices. Okay, certainly the main character, right? You can choose to go here or there, shoot this one or shoot that one, all right? That's very rudimentary, but why not? That can be expanded. Sure, you could give free will to characters. We may all have, you know, God-given. I believe we have free will. I believe we have free will as part of who we are, the way we were. And we're not the only ones. I think all other animals have some degree of free will as well. You know, there's, anyway, this gets very complicated, but the point is that simulation is a very interesting idea. To me, it is ultimately no different than believing in a creator. Now, the big question is, what is the nature of God? And that's sort of beyond me. I can't tell you, you know, too much about that because I don't know. I don't think anyone does, but there are a lot of ideas, and that's way outside of my ability to speak on.
It's interesting you say that, because I think that one of the major points of conflict in religious arguments, or even religious wars, if I may say, is the nature of God, because the nature of God determines the nature of our relationship with God. If we say that God, for example, is omnipotent, so I figured out this, I had this interesting idea a couple of weeks ago, where I thought about it, that if we say God is omnipotent, every other characteristics in the world is subsumed by that main characteristic, because omnipotence is like a meta characteristic where every other thing is inside. If you say he's omnipotent, you can't say he's good, because if he's omnipotent, he must be capable of doing something bad. If you say he's omnipotent, he necessarily is omniscient, because he wouldn't be able to be omniscient if he wasn't able to do everything. Like, being able to know everything is a category under being able to do everything. Then the last one is omnipresence. Obviously, if it wouldn't be omnipotent if he wasn't going to be capable of being everywhere all at once. And so if we assume that God is omnipotent, it brings about a lot of further questions, or further, you know, contradictions down the line, particularly in Christian theology, where you'd have to ask, okay, if God is omnipotent now, and I think this ties nicely, you know, into the second main flaw that you and I mentioned that we're going to discuss, which is the problem of evil, right? So if you have an omnipotent God, which by definition can do everything, there isn't anything, including a logical contradiction, because the laws of logic must not be larger than an omnipotent God. If the laws of logic, if God has to, you know, apply, or if God has to work with any rule, or if there's any rule that he's bound by, he automatically becomes smaller than the rule that bounds him, And so God being omnipotent means God has infinite ability to even do the unthinkable, the impossible, the irrational, the illogical. So are we saying, or do we grant, that this world that we currently are living in now, with the fallen nature, to use, you know, a biblical term, with the evil that we see around us, with the injustices, the pure pain and, you know, meaningless pain that a lot of people endure and go through, are we saying that this world that we're living in now is the best world that an omnipotent being can bring about?
Wow. So let me start by saying that the issue of omnipotence, omnipresence, omniscience, and evil is a very hard one. I don't know answers to what even omnipotence really means. I don't know. But what I do find compelling is the question of the problem of evil, because one would expect that if God were good, all good, and omnipotent, Why would he allow evil? Why would he allow suffering among us? And that's a question that has no answer. I've never heard a good answer for it. But I have a couple of possible reflections on it. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read something from my book, The Language, The Works of His Hands, right. Which, it's easier for me to read it than to try to repeat it. I once knew a woman who was not happy with the house she lived in. It was on a quiet street in a small town with a backyard, a driveway, and a garage, a front and back porch, a living room, dining room, and the kitchen, three bedrooms upstairs, full basement, fireplace, and studio. She felt it was too small, and she wanted to find a bigger house similar to the one where she had grown up in a wealthy suburb. To her, she had a default position, which was to live in a house that was big enough to not be exactly sure how many rooms there were, to feel that space was almost unlimited. She felt that she had descended from her default position. It so happened that I was at the same time involved in an organization doing charity work in the resettling of refugees in the same town. I was a peripheral player, mostly doing grunt work like hauling furniture. I was helping to fix up an apartment that the group had rented for a family about to arrive from Russia. A group of people from my organization met the family in the apartment, and I helped them bring their suitcases inside. They were shown the master bedroom, the living room, the smaller bedroom, and the kitchen. The woman looked around carefully in the kitchen and the other room, speaking to the daughter in a low voice. She didn't seem terribly pleased, although she smiled politely. When she got to the bathroom, she said something that sounded like a question. The leader of our group asked the daughter what she'd asked, and the girl said, "Is only one bathroom?" Our leader replied, "Yes, unfortunately, we can only afford an apartment with one bathroom." He then asked her what the mother thought of the place. There was a brief discussion, and the girl said, "It's very nice. My mother say kitchen small, but okay. But please, we'd like to ask, which room is ours? And how many families will share the apartment?" This is a true story. The point is, the default position of the Russian family was you live in a place with four other families. You have one room, if you're lucky, for all of you. When we told them that it was all for them, they couldn't believe it. They fell on their knees and began to pray. What is the point of this story? It has to do with what the definition of suffering is. Just yesterday, I saw a movie on Netflix, a very difficult movie called Nowhere. About a woman.
I literally watched the movie last week, literally.
Well, I don't know anything more powerful about suffering. I could barely stand watching it. It was, you know, can you imagine a worse situation to be in? And I just tweeted today. I said I saw the movie yesterday. And for some reason, I'm not complaining anymore about slow mail delivery or, you know, problems with my internet. Because my default position is I live in a house. I'm not about to drown. I didn't just have a baby who is unlikely to survive. What is suffering? What is evil? It's relative. And the real question to me is not why does God allow suffering, but what does God do about it? Suffering is real. What I think God does is, and this is largely because I believe of Jesus Christ, what I think Jesus does is he inspires us to end suffering, to reduce suffering. We still suffer, but we don't suffer the way we used to. Most of us. There are places where the suffering is bad, worse. But in many places, and probably everywhere, suffering is decreasing. And that's because of what we do. That's because of what human beings do. And as Christians, we're devoted to do that, to pitch in and help do that as much as we can. And that's the other thing that God does, that Jesus Christ does when you're a believer and you're suffering and you call out, why am I ill? Why did I get hurt? Why did this person die who I loved? Why are you making me suffer? What Jesus does is he points to himself on the cross. And he says, I'm with you. I'm standing with you because I suffer too. And I suffer for you. Now, is that enough? Should we say, okay, so you're saying God is not going to cure us. Jesus did not cure his followers, all of them. He did not heal everybody. Paul suffered. We don't know what his problem was, but he had a thorn of some kind. Coming to Christ doesn't mean you stop suffering. Believing in God doesn't tell you that suffering is over. What it tells you is there is hope for the future because you believe in heaven. And I don't know what heaven is, and I can't talk about it because I have no clue. But I do believe there is something after death. And in that something, we will find what we've been looking for, an end to suffering. And I think that will also happen on earth. The kingdom of God will come to earth. And we're seeing it. I mean, you know, I'm at an age where 200 years ago, there would have been no one my age around. Nobody would have lived this long. And 1,000 years ago, you'd be lucky to hit 40. So there's a progress. It's very uneven. It's just like there's moral progress, also very uneven. It goes up and down. It's roller coaster, much like your path. But it's leading up. It's the saying that Martin Luther King gave, which I never get right, but it's something about the arc of something leads to justice. But it's a long arc. It takes a long time. And we see that. We see that justice is increasing, and then it goes back. You know, it's two steps forward, one step back all the time. But if you look at the long-term trend, it's going up. Now, that's not proof of God, okay? That could simply be that we humans are, you know, using science and doing better things and blah, 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 all that. But I believe it's inspired by faith. And the faith was originally faith in God, and now it may be, for many people, faith in something else. But it came, I believe it came from Jesus. It came from his teachings and his words. And he's with us. So the problem of evil, that's not the answer to the problem of evil. There is no good answer. We don't know it. We don't know it in this life. We won't know it in this life. But part of it is, that part of the clue is, you know, the first woman I mentioned in this story, who's also real, you know, she's suffering because she's in a what's to her a tiny house. It's only got 8 rooms. She's suffering. She wants a house with 15 rooms. Then she can be happy. But it's the Russian family who was happy with their 3 rooms that they had all to themselves. And their suffering was over. So that tells you something.
Do you think God cares for animals?
Oh, wow. I have no idea. That's a whole nother topic.
Because animals suffer terribly in this world. And the worst thing, if I can say, about their suffering is many people don't seem to think about it. It's not easy to empathize with animal suffering. It's not easy to put yourself in their shoes.
No, it isn't. And yeah. So I don't really know the answer to that, because I don't know enough about consciousness in animals. I know that animals have consciousness, but I know that it's not the same as human consciousness. I think that people have said that animals suffer more than humans. I actually don't agree with that, and I'll tell you why. I think what it is that humans suffer terribly when they see an animal in pain. They suffer for that animal. I don't know whether animals suffer the same or worse or more. I doubt that they suffer more, because part of suffering is being aware of what's happening. So I don't know how. Now, some animals may be very aware. I mean, you know, I've seen dogs who are clearly suffering. I don't know about squirrels. I don't know about invertebrates. You know, I mean, do they suffer? Possibly. Who knows? I just don't know. And whether God, I don't know what God's relationship is to animals, which is the question you ask. I have no idea. All we know is that the Bible, in the Bible, the creation of humans was separate. Okay? And only humans were made in the image of God. And what that phrase means, I don't know completely either. That's a very weighty phrase. I think what it means, my own view, is that by being made in the image of God, we have souls of, you know, a divine nature. Where there's something about us that's divine. And what's divine about us? Well, things that I've said, you know, that we can sing. That's divine. That doesn't come from any other explanation. We can have joy. Real deep joy. Now, I know dogs can look joyful. They jump up and down, you know, give you big kisses and stuff. So I'm not putting that down. But I think it's a matter of degree. And humans are, I will have to say this before I go any further. Even as an atheist, I absolutely believed in human exceptionalism. That was just something I felt was an obvious fact that couldn't be contradicted. So humans, I thought, was special. And in fact, that was part of what used to be called humanism, you know, which was a version of atheism. And it's what's interesting now is that atheists are anti-humanist. Part of the atheist credo, and there is an atheist credo, is that humans are nothing special. We're just, you know, animals with slightly better memories. Well, I don't agree with that. I never did. And that wasn't the case for any atheist when I was one. So atheism has also evolved during this period and now has some ideas which I think are ridiculous.
I think they're trying to avoid being caught in the trap of speciesism, where a person is too concerned or, you know, only optimizes for the well-being or the welfare of their own species. Mm-hmm. And so they think, and I'm trying to remember where I heard this argument from, but I know that the core argument that they think is, at least that category of atheists, because I'm certainly aware that it's not all atheists that do believe that. They believe that our concern for humanity is too intense, right? So they think that we are too self-serving. Yes, that's the word.
Yeah.
And I've heard a similar argument recently. I recorded a podcast with someone called Malcolm Collins, who I think is a very fascinating thinker. And one of the things that he mentioned on the podcast was we have a tendency as humans to care a lot for the welfare of people that look like us. And so when we think about humanity itself, there's a tendency for us to care about humans that are currently living now or living now than, you know, the ones that are going to live in the next 5,000 years. But he believes that his commitment is to the existence of life itself and, you know, the flourishing of existence. And so I can personally understand the viewpoint of people who think that, you know, humanity isn't all that special, although I do not, you know, I don't buy into that idea. I think I've always had this consciousness, even as a kid, and this was the reason, like I mentioned to you before we started recording, why I left Christianity when I was 13 initially. I knew that there was something about the human being. It was this understanding that I couldn't explain how I came to understand it. It was more than our, you know, sentience. It was more than our consciousness. It was more than the idea that, you know, we are able to communicate with each other. It just felt like there was something, for the lack of a better word, divine about humans. And I then found out that that was not necessarily the case. I figured out, it was then, you know, I first got like my exposure to ideas like speciesism, where it seems like, oh, we are quite ethnocentric as, you know, beings, where we tend to look out for the welfare. We optimize for the welfare or the well-being of our group, whatever group we are in. And when that group becomes humanity, you know, we tend to see humanity as all there is. I no longer hold that position, but I think it was an interesting, position that I held then, just to, you know, buttress what you were saying. But I think an interesting question that I have for you that logically flows out of this conversation is, when we say something is divine, we all have an idea of what we're talking about in our own heads. So when I say that I perceive that humanity is divine, I'm talking about a certain mode of existence. I'm talking about a certain characteristic, a certain perception. But I don't know how to operantly define it, because it's hard to grasp the concept, you know, that we're talking about. It seems like that which is beyond what we know, but then it's also sufficiently ahead of our ability to understand that we cannot fully encapsulate it within a certain definition. That is my personal understanding of what the divine is, and I'm curious to know what yours is, and how do you think we can define the divine, if it's possible at all?
Yeah, I think your definition is a good one. The only thing I would add to it is that, you know, the whole question of naturalistic science. In other words, if we can't understand a characteristic of a being, like a human or any other being, through what we know of the science of how, you know, chemistry, physics, biology work, then we could call that what you just said. In other words, what you said, the unknown. And so I would just say unknown by scientific answers. Okay. So that can change. I mean, that definition can change because we learn more and more about science all the time. So some things that we used to think were might be considered divine maybe would not anymore, because science has explained, you know, where that comes from. But I think there are some things that, you know, that, I mean, there are some people who use evolution to explain things which it really does not explain. So the whole idea of human morality, for example, which is probably another question you have on your list. You know, there's an evolutionary explanation for morality, which is that groups of people who were good to each other did better than groups of people who weren't, so that's why we are moral. It doesn't work. It's evolutionary. It doesn't make any sense scientifically in terms of the theory of evolution. I can't go into why. It's too long and complicated.
I think it would be super interesting if you can give a summary of why you think it's so, because that is my position, my current position on morality, I've always thought of it as, you know, the behaviors that helped the group survive were, you know, classified as good. The ones that didn't were bad.
I can answer that fairly quickly by saying that there are two kinds of evolution applied to humans. The original evolution, which does not apply to anybody, the original kind of evolution, which applies to all living creatures, is Darwinian evolution by natural selection. Okay, and that's a theory that's all about genes and what genes do. Okay, so there are genetics that involve your body and to some extent your brain as well. But then there's another form of evolution that only applies to human beings, and that's cultural evolution. And that does not relate to genes. That relates to our brains, to what we think and what we, you know, our consciousness. Now, the first kind of evolution, genetic evolution, has very little to do with human beings now. There are very few genetic variables that are connected to modern humans. In other words, changes, mutations. The main one that's still going around is the ability to drink milk as adults. Adult mammals can't drink milk. They don't drink milk. Milk is only for babies. And that was true for humans too. There are several mutations that change that for adult humans. And we now, as many of us, can drink milk, but many of us still cannot, including in Africa and parts of Asia, et cetera. So that's a mutation that is still moved because that kind of evolution, genetic evolution, evolutionary theory based on natural selection, is incredibly slow. It takes a very long time in our terms, okay? And humans aren't around that. We've only been around 200,000 or 300,000 years. That's nothing in time. So we have not evolved very much at all genetically, and we probably never will, because in order to have evolution, you have to have population separation, and we don't have that. Human populations are constantly moving, okay? And so there's constant inbreeding and intermarrying and mixing of populations, always has been. Anyway, I used to study population genetics, and I can go into a long speech about that, but that would be off the topic. Let's go back to cultural evolution. Cultural evolution is the predominant way that we change. I mean, our bodies, physically, we're exactly the same as humans were 100,000 years ago. But we don't live that.
Do you think so?
Oh, that's a fact. That's just true. Our bodies are the same. I mean, there's been some changes. We're taller, you know, there, but the genetics are pretty much the same. And the reason for some of the, you know, the phenotypic changes that we see are due to actually cultural evolution more than you know, Darwinian evolution. And Richard Dawkins has said this too. He has said that we're no longer bound by evolutionary dynamics of the Darwinian type, because we've gotten out of it, and we're now ruled by cultural evolution. And that's why he coined the phrase meme, which means, you know, an idea. And he said ideas mutate and change and spread just like genes do, but much, 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 much faster. I mean, nowadays it's, you know, every week there's a new meme. So that's what makes us do, say, think, and act the way we do. It's the that kind of change, cultural evolution. That's what technology is. That's what language development is. That's what all the cultural norms are. You know, the methods of government, morality. The reason that a tribe of people who were good to each other did better than a tribe of people who kept stabbing each other is cultural evolution. It was an idea. Jesus was part of cultural evolution. He brought some new ideas to the table. And so morality is, yes, it's evolutionarily based, but it's not natural selection. Cultural evolution also has natural selection. I don't want to confuse that. So if a group of people get together and they think and they decide, let's plant some crops, because I have a feeling that that seed may produce another plant. Okay, that's cultural evolution, and it made a huge difference. You know, I mean, it changed human life forever. And every single technological advance has been the same. So what we're doing right now, talking to each other across continents, across time and space, you know, and we see each other. This is insane. Nobody in the 19th century would have thought we could do this. It's a result of cultural evolution. It's technology. And yeah, it has tremendous impact on our lives, but only on us. No chimpanzee, as smart as they are, and no dolphin, to my knowledge, has ever created an internet meme or even run a podcast.
So how does that tie to the origin of morality for you? Like, so if you say that it's not from the evolutionary pressure,
it's from cultural evolutionary pressure. And the reason we have such cultural evolutionary pressure is because we have brains and minds and souls. And all you have to do, I really recommend again, Holland's book, Dominion. The morality of the Roman Empire, if we went back and tried to live there, we would run away. I mean, people were horrible to each other. They didn't think they were. But, you know, if you saw a slave on the street and you knew it was a slave right away, you just kick him. You wouldn't give him anything ever. It's a slave. You know, and if you were a nobleman, you would do the same thing to the middle class, to the people. I mean, it was all hierarchical. Everything was, you know, it still is. But, you know, the difference is that there's this idea that, well, maybe you shouldn't actually, you know, kill people who you think are beneath you. So, you know, all of these things are memes. They're cultural. They're culturally selected ideas that arise within a culture. And then if they're successful, if they're selected for, if they work, they're spread until they don't work anymore.
You mentioned something earlier on, which was that humanity has been around for 200,000 to 300,000 years. That means that you don't take into literal account the Bible's account of creation, which is that the world was made in 6 days.
No.
Man was made on the sixth. So how do you...
I'm not a young earth creationist. No, I'm not. That, by the way, young earth creationism is... it's a new idea. It's not a foundational idea in Christianity. It was invented in the 19th century by Seventh-day Adventists. And then it spread to the Southern Baptist Convention, and then it spread around the world. But it's not the original Christianity.
So what was the original Christian's account of creation?
The original Christian account of creation was Genesis, that says 6 days. But the age of the earth was kept changing depending on what people, I mean, the 6,000 years was from Bishop Usher in, I don't remember what, 15th century. I don't remember what century he lived. But that was based on the calculations of the genealogies in Genesis, from Adam to Abraham, and that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, this is based on a writing in, I mean, I don't take the Bible literally seriously at every word that it says. I think it's inerrant, but it's only inerrant when you interpret it properly. And when young earth creationists say, you don't have to interpret the Bible, just take it literally as what it says, they don't do that at all. They interpret it all the time. Even the age of the earth is an interpretation, which Bishop Usher did. And, you know, when you ask them who was Cain's wife, they will give you an answer that is so twisted because they don't want to admit that humanity started with, you know, incest. But that's the only answer, is that, you know, Cain married one of the other kids from Adam and Eve. So, yeah, no, I mean, I firmly believe that, that, you know, Adam and Eve may have been real, but they were not the original first two humans. That can't be true. It's also genetically impossible, by the way. But that's
exactly. I was going to say that the problem that inevitably, you know, brings us to is genetic diversity.
Yeah,
like it is
exactly.
Impossible. It's ridiculous to believe. And, you know, I'm not one who necessarily points out the ridiculousness of belief, but then some beliefs are just downright ridiculous.
Yes,
you're
like, I agree with you. And that's why I say that this is not a fundamental part of Christianity. I certainly hold to the theory of evolution. I certainly hold to an old earth. I believe that the Bible is a book of truth, but it's not literal truth because, you know, they were not scientists and they didn't have any scientific information when they wrote it. It's very possible that God told the writers of the Bible, he said, you know, 14 billion years ago, there was a big bang. And what would the writers say? 14 what? Billion?
Yeah, they couldn't conceptualize billion. Yeah, billion is just a recent idea of humanity or of mathematics.
They don't even know that there's a universe. They know that there's some stars in the sky. I mean, you know, they wrote what they knew. They wrote the best they could. And, you know, for us to take that literally is ridiculous. It's insane. And it comes from a particular Christian cult that's a little strange, you know. I mean, I have friends in Seventh-day Adventists. They're good people. They're not crazy. But to take that idea literally, seriously, is really weird.
I wanted to mention that you also mentioned that to take the Bible is inerrant, but then for it to be inerrant, it has to be interpreted correctly. I think that becomes quite shaky there, because the question then becomes, what is accurate interpretation?
Yeah, and that is a question that which does not have a simple answer. There are many good theologians who've written many books about this question. I can mention, you know, N.T. Wright, John Walton, oh my goodness, there's so many, Roy Clouser, many of the well-known apologists have written on this. You know, the idea that you have to take even Hugh Ross, who is very well known and holds to an old earth, but he doesn't go with evolution, but whatever. And there's a huge range within Christianity of how to interpret the Bible. And the idea that, you know, Ken Ham and Kent Hovind that say that you just read the words and that's it. Well, that's ridiculous. You don't do that with anything other than a phone directory, not even a cookbook. Nobody takes anything literally, right? Cookbook says, you know, add three measures. Show it to your mother or some other cook and they'll say, no, we don't add three. I add 2.5 because it's better that way. Nobody takes anything literally. So it's absurd to say every word in the Bible is exactly what it says. No, it's written in English. It's translated from Greek, from Hebrew. Come on. You know, if you don't even know the original language, how can you say, take it literally?
How then can we verify the inerrancy of the Bible outside of, you know, dogma? Because I think dogma is the only thing that predisposes you to accept that something is so without, I mean, either dogma or, what's the other word now?
Because you should not use the Bible as a substitute for any other for other sources of knowledge. The Bible is there for a very particular purpose. And also, by the way, the Bible is two different things. It's the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the New Testament overrules the Old Testament. So nobody says we should be stoning people who sin. No Christian, I mean. Nobody says, actually no Jews either. Nobody says we have to sacrifice at a particular altar to God. There's no sacrifice anywhere in Judaism or Christianity anymore. So the Old Testament, several books of which are all about sacrificing, is irrelevant today. Now, on the other hand, some people will take those passages, both Jews and Christians, and interpret them in terms of what is the underlying moral, ethical, religious thing that is being said here out beyond the actual literal speech, the literal words that are in that. I frankly concentrate on the New Testament because I'm a Christian. I'm fascinated in by the life and teachings of Jesus Christ and the people who came after him and the development of Christianity. And I will read parts of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, things like that, a little bit. But to me, I don't, this is just me, okay? I'm not speaking for all Christians here at all. Many Christians will disagree with me, but I find much more inspiration in the New Testament than I do in the Old. Now, there are inspiring parts of the Old Testament. There are so many things. Before I became a Christian, but when I was still an atheist, I had no idea that so many of the phrases and proverbs I used to say were actually from the Bible, because I had never read the Bible. When I started reading the Bible, I said, oh, that's where that comes from. You know, there's a huge amount of wisdom in the Bible. There's also a lot of bad stuff. I mean, you know, I don't have to tell you. I mean, you know, everybody knows that the stuff in the Bible you wish weren't there. And I don't apologize for it. I don't say, well, it means this. He didn't really mean kill the kids. I don't, you know, it was an ancient tribe. Everybody was killing everybody. They didn't have Christian values. They had tribal values. And one thing they had was they believed in this crazy idea of an invisible God. Well, you know, nobody else did. Well, maybe a few people, but, you know, that was a crazy idea. How can you have a God who's immaterial, who doesn't even have a name? You have no statues. What kind of a God is that? Well, they believed in it. And that part makes it worthwhile, just that they had this incredibly crazy new idea, which I believe is true.
And so how do you account for the inerrancy of the Bible?
So, yeah, and you know, you have to take that with a grain of salt, because when I say inerrant, I'm only referring to it in sense of its underlying spirituality. It doesn't mean that everything in it is true. Okay, it can't be. I mean, nobody thinks that a serpent actually started talking. I mean, nobody thinks that. So, you know, it's silly to use that as an argument against faith, because that's not the point. So it's like if you hear a story, or take any of Jesus' parables, okay? Jesus didn't speak the truth when he told a story. He told a story about a father and a son. One went away, one stayed home. A landowner who had workers. Were there really such a father? And so, it may have been, but that wasn't the point. He was telling stories to convey truths, spiritual truths. Okay, the workers who complained because they were paid less than they thought they thought they should have gotten a full day's wage, and the other people should have gotten less than a full day's wage because they only worked an hour. Okay, what is that parable? That's telling you something. That's telling you that when you come to do work, when you come to help, it doesn't matter when you started. The fact is you're there. You're now working. I didn't come to God till I was 65. Okay? And I don't think that's going to hurt me when I get to heaven. It doesn't matter. We consider people saved if they confess belief in Jesus on their deathbed. You don't have to start from zero. You can come at any time. That's what that parable means. So is that inerrant? Yes, because its message is true. It doesn't mean there actually was a guy who, you know, a worker who got upset because he, you know, wasn't paid more.
So then, does the person who believes in the literal truth of the Bible, like in the literal written word, and the person who understands the metaphorical truth that is implied in those words, do they believe in the same thing? Can they both be regarded as Christians?
Yes.
Or better still, a more interesting variation of this would be, considering the multiplicity of possible interpretations of the Bible, each and every one of those people, regardless of how right or wrong they are, from the objective, you know, the objective desire of the author of, you know, each of those books in the Bible, would they also be considered believers?
Yes.
Seeing that what they believe is inaccurate.
Yeah, not everybody has to believe the same thing. That's really, really, really important. If it's nothing else you take away from this conversation, not everybody has to believe the same thing is what you should have. And that's true for religion. It's true for politics. It's true for morality. It's true for everything in life. You don't all have to agree. In fact, we're not supposed to all agree. It's better if we don't, because then we have diversity and we have progress. The worst thing is for everybody to believe exactly the same thing. That's Nazi Germany. That's Stalin Russia. That's bad if you all believe the same thing. I have very good friends who are absolute 100% young earth creationists, and we love each other because we know, and everyone agrees, even the strong, well, with one or two major exceptions, but everyone else agrees that none of these issues are salvational issues. If you confess that Jesus Christ lived, died, and rose from the dead, and that he is your savior, you are a Christian. And whether or not the earth was 6 days, 10 days in making, or, you know, a billion, 2 billion years, that doesn't matter. Jesus Christ is real and is our savior.
Dr. Sai, it's been an amazing pleasure talking to you. I have not only been blessed by your intellectual honesty and your humble, you know, your humble approach to the questions that you don't know the answers of. You have been a joy to speak with, and I'm sure the listeners can also attest to that. And thank you very much for your time today. I've learned so much. It's been so, so interesting speaking with you.
Well, it's been a blessing for me to talk to you. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. Where can the audience go to, you know, learn more about your stuff? I know you have a book that's coming out next year. So where can they go to, you know,
well,
try and pre-order the book?
The best place to go is my website, saigart.com. Very easy. Saigart.com. There I have links to my books. Oh, I have a lot of stuff. It's all there. You can sign up for my newsletter there, which comes out once a month, and I just keep you up to date on what I'm doing. You can contact me. I answer all contacts. Sometimes it may take me a day or so, but I answer everybody. You can also look at my resume and my CV and find out I'm actually a real scientist, and look at my papers, and my publications, things like that. So, yeah, it's all there. I also have a blog, and there's a link to the blog there too.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sai, once again, and do have an interesting rest of the day.
I will. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.